Thank you very much for coming in. I certainly appreciate it. I wanted to chat with you for a long time. I really enjoyed the Lost Father. I was looking at your itinerary. My God.
I know.
You're devoting almost the entire month of January and February and part of March to a nationwide tour, huh?
Well, not that long. Most of February. Not too much of January.
End of January, all of February.
Yeah, and one thing in March.
Uh-huh. Are you going to Racine?
No, actually. I'm going to Madison.
It's close enough.
Somewhere in there, yeah.
I guess in...
Aren't I back the last week in February? I hope I am.
You'll be back in New York on the 27th.
Good.
On the 25th, actually. Actually, in anywhere but here, Racine is really Bay City, isn't it?
Yeah.
You kind of changed the names a little bit.
Yeah, I changed the names, and eventually I'll get them coordinated.
How about all the characters' names and everything? They're pretty much
the
same, though.
They're coordinated, yeah.
Yeah. It's just the locale that you just have different names for, but they're the same place.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, let's go back.
I changed it, and basically it's one of those things where they do reprint the paperback, but only at certain points, so when they reprint it, they'll change it to make it consistent.
Is this the first paperback edition?
No, that's the second.
Uh-huh. This is a trade edition.
Yeah.
It has not been in a popular
edition. No, it's not been in one of those little ones.
Yeah. Those are kind of nice to have because
you
have at airports.
I know. I like those, too. I wish they'd do it.
When I was a kid, I grew up on those books, you know?
I know. I think they're a good thing. They're cheap.
Well, when I was a kid, of course, a long time before you were a kid, but 25 cents.
Oh, well, that's a deal.
35 cents.
That's a real deal.
That's where my science fiction came from. I spotted a really interesting paperback with lots of pictures called, I think it was called The History of Burlesque.
Hmm.
And it had pictures of turn-of-the-century burlesque performers, I guess. I don't know if they were called burlesque performers then, but they wore these... Well, they weren't nude. I mean, they were fully dressed, as you know.
Hmm.
It had Fanny Bryce in it. And I thought,
oh,
gee,
oh, great.
That really looks interesting. It was a paperback, a lot of
pictures. Is it a contemporary book? I mean, is it out now? Or
no, I have no idea. I don't even remember the name of it. But anyway, I saw it and I thought, boy, that looks interesting. Because I used to hear Fanny Bryce's Baby Snooks on the radio when I was real little. And I took it to the druggist. And he looked at it and he said, I can't sell this to you. He said, you'll have to come back with a note giving your mother's permission.
That's great.
And that was in the 50s, you know, and it was just a history of vaudeville and burlesque and things like that. But they were protecting my morals. I guess I owe the druggist something. Well,
that's a long time ago.
Yeah, really. Well, speaking of a long time ago, let's talk a little bit about you. And you better not touch the mic. You'll get a clunk, a thump, bang. Just talk a little bit about yourself and where you grew up and what life was like. A literary household?
No, not particularly. I mean, my family's all pretty well educated, but they're mostly interested in other things, which is actually a great relief if you're a writer. It's nice. I mean, my family doesn't read book reviews particularly or literary magazines or anything like that. So if I have something in and I want them to read it, I have to tell them. But actually, there's a great freedom to that because you don't worry about their judgment, or you don't worry that they'll be embarrassed if you have a bad review, or it's really something they're not into particularly or up on, except because I do it, which is actually nice. I'm now married and I have in-laws who are all great readers of fiction and also great readers of reviews and all that. So it's a whole new thing in a way, having a book come out, knowing that my husband's four grandparents will read the reviews in the New York Times. And it was another concern. It made me understand the differences between between coming from a sort of very literary household and not. There's a certain pressure that you don't feel if your family is involved in other things.
Do you have siblings?
Yes.
How many?
One.
A sister?
Brother.
Does your family read your material?
They read my books. I wouldn't say they read contemporary fiction in general too often. So they like my books, but then again, they're the only novels they might have read in the last 5 years. So there's a certain amount of bias there.
Do you get a little nervous that something you write might hit home too much?
No. I mean, they know what they know. You know, they know what's fiction and what's fact. So no, they've been great.
And they also know that's what you do.
Yeah.
That's what I do.
Right, right.
This is what I do.
I think they're greatly relieved. I mean, I think when you have a kid who's going to be a writer, you're greatly relieved when they're, you know, making a living at all.
You grew up in Wisconsin.
Yes.
But you left as, I read the biographical material in the publicity package, you left in your early teens, is that right?
Yes.
California?
Yeah. And then I stayed in California and went to school at Berkeley, at the University of California, Berkeley.
What point in your young life did you have some inkling that you might someday be a writer?
Well, I started, my mom actually bought me a little typewriter when I was in high school, I guess. She thought I should learn to type. And so I had this little sort of lemon yellow typewriter. And I, all through high school, I wrote stories and poems. And so I liked that. I was interested in that. But I also was interested in visual art at the time, too. I spent most of my life in high school in the pottery room. They had a big ceramics room where I went to school. So I wanted to do something in the arts, but I didn't know what. And then when I got to college, I really knew that this was it. You fall into these things the most incidental way. I mean, I think when I was a freshman in high school, I had a crush on a fellow who was older. And I never really got to know him well, but just from a few things he'd said in passing, we never went out on a date or anything. He had said he loved Yeats, and I assumed that Yeats was spelled phonetically, like Y-A-T-E-S. So I went to the bookstore and read all of Richard Yeats, who was, of course, a fiction writer. And years later, I became friends with this fellow, and it turns out he meant the poet.
Whereas Richard Yeats is not a bad reader.
No, he's a terrific writer. So it was great because I ended up reading all of both of them. And in college, I quite serious. The first actual class I took as a freshman in college, I somehow managed to talk my way into a little seminar, a sort of upperclassman seminar on William Butler Yeats, since I still hadn't gotten that out of my system. And I really knew I wanted to write and read. I considered other things because I worried about the precarious life that would mean, but by the time I was a sophomore or something, I knew that was what I was going to try to do, to be a writer.
In a way, that's unusual. You mentioned, you used the term fall into things a moment ago, but that seems to be what a lot of writers do. I talked to a novelist named Sam Topaloff yesterday, a day before yesterday. I don't know if you know him.
He
wrote a very nice a novel in which he fantasizes about Marilyn Monroe. It's called The Queen of Desire. Just came out.
Great subject.
Yeah, and he fantasizes in this novel about what Marilyn Monroe would be like at various stages of her life and how she would deal with certain problems and people in their lives and so forth.
That's a neat idea.
Yeah.
That's a great idea.
But he's a man well in his 60s. He's written a number of nonfiction books, but he was a school teacher. He taught at Hofstra for years and years and years. More than 20 years he taught there. But it never occurred to him that he would be a writer. He was an athlete in high school, and he thought he might like to be a baseball player or something like that. But that's him. You, at a very early age, said, I want to be a writer, and apparently set about it in a dogged fashion, because it seems to me a field that's very discouraging. I said I wanted to be a writer when I was in college, and indeed I studied creative writing in addition to my journalism, but it didn't seem to be the kind of field that I would be successful in or that I could make a living in. And so I stuck with the journalism. But it's different with you. And there are other people, too. I mean, I bump into them. They've all gone to the Iowa Writers' Workshop. And they have that single-minded purpose. But I think it takes a unique mentality to want to do it, and two, to be able to do it. Maybe you could comment on that.
Well, I think that's true. I think also there's a lot of luck involved. I mean, I think it's funny. I was a journalist, too, and after college, I had this idea. I was writing mostly poetry, but some short stories in college, and I had this idea that I'd be a journalist to support my fiction, which turned out to be a hilarious joke because my journalism was quite unlucrative. I mean, I did a very long piece on San Francisco's General Hospital, which is the place where most of the city's indigents who just walk in are treated. And it's also a teaching hospital, so it was sort of an interesting hospital. And I did a long piece on that, and I also did a long piece on incest and incest programs and incest treatment. And I got very involved in both these projects and in whichever stories I did, and I'd spend months. And then I'd finally sell the piece, and it would run, and if I was lucky, I'd get $300, which barely covered, the gas in my car to have gone to do the reporting. So then I finally got a job to support my journalism, which was supposed to support my fiction, and it became kind of funny. But I think part of it is just also a matter of, I think I always would have been a writer eventually, but I think, I have friends in New York who, after college, came here and maybe got jobs at the Village Voice and got to write maybe a little paragraph-long review. And because it was the Village Voice, they were nervous and they were tentative and they felt so cowed, in a way, by the grandeur of it.
May I speak parenthetically? There
sure.
is no such thing as a one-paragraph review in the Village Voice. They go 5-6 pages.
That's funny. Well, I think maybe my friends were given smaller things to write then, because I know that I had the advantage, in a way, of writing in a much smaller provincial place. I mean, in Berkeley, there were all these. I started out writing for free newspapers that you didn't have to pay to get, and they would take on a college kid who hadn't written anything, and they'd let you write, a 10-page story, and they'd edit it with you, and they'd print it, and you wouldn't get paid much, but at least you really got to feel that you could write the piece, and it would go in, and you didn't feel so. I never felt cowed in a way by the greater establishment of it all, and so I think that's good for a writer in a way. I think it was. After a while of doing journalism in the Bay Area, after 2 years, you almost felt, you felt you knew a lot. You felt you understood the region, and you felt you saw the same people again and again, and you knew the mayor, not personally, but I mean, you knew what the mayor did. You knew what the city attorney was.
And you probably did.
Yeah, you did. And so it was a much smaller region. It was easier to see all its layers in a way. I think if I'd been in New York, I would have felt shakier at that time.
Maybe at that time, but I've worked in a lot of places, small cities, medium cities, places like Pittsburgh, Baltimore before I came to New York. And essentially it's the same. There are smaller versions of New York.
I guess
that's
true.
But the prime characters are always the same ones.
That's funny.
We talk about these microcosms
mm-hmm.
all through The Lost Father. There are little towns that you
mm-hmm.
drive to, and in each town, it's almost the same as in the big city. The
mm-hmm.
same kinds
no,
of people.
No, I think that's true. I think that's true.
So, did you study journalism at Berkeley?
No, I actually studied fiction and poetry.
Mm-hmm.
I took one class in journalism, in reviewing from Ben Bagdikian, who's a great teacher, actually.
Didn't he work on the Daily News?
I think he did, yeah.
For a long time.
Yeah.
And I think he wrote a
written a couple of books on the
He wrote a book on broadcasting, as I recall, that I read a long time ago.
He's a great teacher, a great man.
Well, you started writing short stories, I guess.
Yeah, at Berkeley, and poems a lot. I think, you were talking about determination before and sort of knowing early what you're going to do. I think also, I didn't identify it as this at the time, and maybe I'm rewriting history, but I think also being a girl at that time, or being female, I noticed in my students, I think there's almost a more desperate sense of wanting to know what you want to do and be absolute about it and committed, because there's this sense that there's this kind of wave that if not, there's always the chance that you'll get swept up in marriage and family, and you'll wake up and you'll be 60 and you won't have done it. I think I've always felt a little bit that I didn't quite have leisure to amble around for 15 years finding a career. Now, that might be inaccurate. I mean, that might be...
Are you saying that there's a fear among some women that they might get married, have a family, and in effect get trapped by the family and not able to fulfill a career?
But I think there's a feeling that right now I want to be a writer, and if I don't really do something about it now, I might forget that desire. It might be subsumed by something else. I don't feel that quite so much anymore.
Well, I was talking to a young writer named Rick Bass.
Yeah, I know Rick Bass.
You know Rick?
I like his work.
I guess you know he lives in Montana, in the very rural area of Montana. And I asked him why he wanted to go there. He had a lot of reasons, but one of the reasons was I wanted to go while I was young enough and I could do it. And he's right. I mean, here I'm a middle-aged man. It would be absurd for me to think about going to Montana to a mountaintop.
I disagree with you entirely. I think I'm always telling my parents this, that I've met people who've changed their entire careers and their lives at 60. And it's been wonderful for them. I think there's really, it's never too late to make your life more of what you want it to be.
Sam Topaloff, the man I just spoke about, quit Hofstra and is now writing full-time.
Yeah.
Now maybe he got a nice pension or something from Hofstra, but he's a man
in his 60s. Well, he probably worked it out in some ways. I teach writing. I teach a writing workshop, and once in a while I'll get an older student, and usually they're the ones who really get going fast, because they're there because they know they want to be. They've waited a long time. They've got so much time to work in, and they use it. They're not dallying. They're not worrying. They're just doing it. And usually they're the ones who publish first and really know what they want to do and commit themselves to it.
I have a feeling that maybe they haven't mastered the technique as well, but they know more.
Mm-hmm. You know, inevitably,
they have a lifetime of experiences to draw on.
Although you can never tell. Sometimes I've had students who are... I have a student now who's 21 or 22 who had the most arduous childhood. I mean, she was basically tortured by a schizophrenic relative who's now institutionalized. But, she's just a kid in a lot of ways, and there's a lot she doesn't know, but there's so much she has seen already, too.
There was an interesting profile of Robert Stone in the Sunday New York Times magazine last weekend. Did you read it?
I read that.
Well, at one point, he is quoted as saying that when he wrote his first novel, Hall of Mirrors, which took him about 5 years to write, in effect, he didn't write anything for another 10 or more years. And he is quoted in this article, something to the effect of saying, put everything he had in that novel. Mm-hmm. Every nuance.
Yeah.
Everything he had learned up to that point. And he was young, too. He was in his mid-20s, I guess. But everything went in there.
Yeah.
And when he finished, he didn't have anything else he could say.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Took a while to get... Mailer was saying the same thing. And in fact, he probably exaggerated, as he usually does, but he was in a while ago to promote Howard's Ghost. And he was 23, I believe, about 23 when he wrote The Naked and the Dead. That was a prime experience for him. And he didn't write any major fiction after that for years because he said, in effect, he had nothing else to say. It took him years in order to come to grips with his life and try to figure out what to write about and how to say it. The two novels you wrote immediately after The Naked and the Dead, I think The Deer Park... and I can't remember the name of the other, were not considered very good. And the critics really trounced them. And he gave up writing fiction for years, switched to journalism, won 2 Pulitzer Prizes. I mean, he was no slouch at journalism either. And says, now, however, his first love is fiction, and that's what he wants to do. And indeed, that's what he has been doing the last couple of years, Ancient Evenings and Harlot's Ghost, big mammoth books. But it took him a long time. And here's a guy, he's 68, 69.
Well, then, too, the journalism served him well because he's done this one, you know, like, I love The Executioner's Song. I think that's a great, great, great book, which is really a rare hybrid of the two. So don't you think of journalism and fiction?
It is supposed to be, yes, and it's supposed to be in the mold of in cold blood.
Yeah, it is, yeah, in a way.
You can't. You don't know how much is really Mailer and how much is not.
Yeah, it's true.
Well, first, before we go on to The Lost Mother, I think we have to precede it with Anywhere But Here. That was your first book, and you worked on that for a long time, didn't you?
Yeah, 4 or 5 years.
And you published, how old were you when you published that?
I was 29 when it came out.
So you started that in your mid-20s.
Yeah,
early
to mid-20s.
Well, you had certainly had a very precocious beginning as a writer, didn't you?
I don't know, 29 that young, it seems.
Well, it seems young to me. 29 seems precocious
to
someone like myself.
I was poor, quite poor in my 20s. It seemed a long time to be that uncertain and poor and struggling, but it was fine. It was a good age to publish the first book for me. I wasn't too young so that I was, you know, thrown off balance by having a book come out.
Why, did somebody tell you that writing was going to make you rich and glamorous?
Oh, God, no, I never expected that. I started as a poet, you have to remember, and most poets, no matter how good or even fortunate and, you know, well-received their work is, always have to do something else. I mean, Wallace Stevens worked his whole life as an insurance executive, and you know, there's hundreds of stories like that among our poets and poets in other languages too. So I never really expected to make a living from writing.
I'm glad you started as a poet. It gave you, I'm sure, an edge over most people who are not poetic, because it gave you a better command of the language, how to use metaphor, how to speak artistically. I think that's very important. And you certainly, you can tell you're a poet in reading your books.
Thank you.
You can see it. You can see it in the language. And I think that's important for a creative writer, because journalists, like people like Les Witten and a few others who've also written novels, you can tell they're not poets. I mean, they write in a very, not necessarily bad, but it's a very spare, almost journalistic style, which is almost antithetical to being a poet. Does that make sense?
That makes sense. I think there's a certain music in the language that you look for in literature. You want there to be a music and a rhythm that's identifiable with the writer. You want to be able to take two sentences out of a book or a short story and know that these are two Tolstoyan sentences, or I suppose it doesn't work as well in translation, but those are two Faulkner sentences. You wouldn't confuse two Faulknerian sentences with two Whitman-esque sentences or two Willa Cather sentences.
Tell me about how Anywhere But Here came about.
I started out with the character of a mother putting her child... It's funny to hear your story about the policeman, because I started with the image of a mother putting her child out by the side of the road and driving off. And that's really what I started with. And the characters pretty much grew out of that.
But you drew on a lot of your own personal knowledge.
I certainly did with the places I've lived. And yeah, I've certainly used the places I've lived in all my fiction. I haven't written about exotic locales at all. But the people are largely, you know, fragments of myself or things in the air. They're not, I haven't used my own family stories, per se.
The reception to Anywhere But Here was certainly favorable. What was your reaction when you began to read the reviews and things?
I was pleased, although I was also a little, it's funny, it's a little nervous-making anyway, you know, I mean, even, of course, you're much more pleased to get a good review, I think, than a bad review, but at the same time, it's the feeling I imagine people have when they take their children to these sort of interviews to get into school or something, you know, these schools these days who sort of inspect your children and decide whether they're smart enough to come. It's a strange feeling if it's good, and it's a strange feeling if it's bad. You know, it's a strange feeling to sort of read such dispassionate judgments of your book.
Yeah, they are dispassionate judgments with very little comprehension about what a writer actually goes through in trying to create it. It is said, however, that it's just as hard to write
a review.
It's just as hard to write a bad book as it is a good book.
Oh, I'm sure that's true, sure. And I'm writing a review at the moment and of William Maxwell's new collection of short stories, which I really love. And it's terribly hard to write a review as well. I think it's hard to... I really love this book, and it's... I think it's almost harder to write a review that sounds persuasive of a book you're quite taken with, as I am with this one, because I feel I'm sort of repeating myself or summarizing the plot or something. It's...
The kind of review I hate are the ones that don't tell you whether or not the reviewer likes the book.
Yeah, I don't like that either.
You read it and you find out a little bit about the book, but at the end you don't know if it's if the reviewer thinks it's a good book or not.
Yeah, I agree with you.
By the same token, it doesn't really matter what the reviewer thinks. I mean, it may help sales or it may not. I don't know, but it's only an opinion.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
But unlike Robert Stone, you did not write yourself out after Anywhere But Here.
No, I didn't feel I did. I still feel at the point in my life where I have a lot to say. That might change. And if so, good, I'll go and have some adventures.
How can it change? You're always going to grow and develop and meet new people and
yeah,
have new experiences.
I hope so.
You're married now, you might have a family, a whole new dimension to your existence.
So that's true.
How did you support yourself over the course of writing these two wonderful books?
Oh, so many ways. I've really been working forever. I guess I've been working, you know, since I was 13 or 14. At first illegally even, which was kind of exciting. I started out, I guess my first job in life was, some of my first jobs were my more romantic jobs that writers classically have. When I was 13 and 14, I was a waitress, and another time I worked in an ice cream parlor as the person who made the sundaes and the milkshakes. I did that for a couple of years during high school, and I also worked as a Christmas wrapper in a clothing store and as a stock clerk. So I did all of those kind of jobs when I was very young. And then during college, I worked as an assistant to an acupuncturist. I was in Berkeley, and there was a psychiatrist I worked for who had become an acupuncturist. He was bored. He was an active sort of fellow. He didn't like listening to people's problems all day, so he learned to be an acupuncturist. So I was his assistant. And then I worked as a journalist and a press agent. I was the person who wrote press releases for a theater in the Bay Area that brought, like, Marcel Marceau and dance groups and stuff, so I would write, you know, on April 29th, the Béjart Ballet will appear at 8 p.m. in Zellerbach Auditorium. and then when I came to New York, I supported myself writing reviews and teaching the spare substitute class. And then I got a job part-time at the Paris Review, which is a literary magazine. I worked as an editor there for a couple of years.
Well, that should be interesting.
Yeah. That was
Are you
really
still
fun.
Working there?
No, it's one of those, it's a sort of mom-and-pop operation. It's very tiny. The office where everybody works is about the size of that thing over there, very small. But so even though I don't work there anymore, I'm still friends with everyone because the people who I hired and who were the young people in the office when I was there are now running it, so I know them all.
Paris Review actually paid a salary?
Well, the word salary is a very labile term. It was certainly close to what the U.S. government would term to be the poverty line. But they did actually pay us a salary, sure.
Well, it was a wonderful thing, though.
It was a wonderful thing. And actually, I did manage to, with the help of my landlord, who has quite inexpensive apartments, you know, and their rent stabilized, and who fortunately gave me a wonderful, well, I mean, anyway, an apartment with a window, which was under $400, you know, at the time. With the help of that, I was able to make a living from working at the Paris Review. So it was great.
Well, I noticed you also had some grants. I noticed
yes.
You had some acknowledgments in the Lost
That's
Fathers.
That's true, although that was after the first book.
Uh-huh.
And since then, I've had a much easier time. I had a Guggenheim and a National Endowment for the Arts, and I had the Hodder Fellowship at Princeton for a year. And also now I teach.
But those grants probably have given you...
Those are great, yes.
Long spaces of
yes,
time in which to work.
That's been the most glorious, luxurious.
Well, let's talk about The Lost Father, which is a book I read this week. It took me about 2.5 days to read it. It's a lot of material in there. And it's a wonderful book. I found it very hard to put down, very moving. You yourself, in effect, lost your father when you were in your early teens. Did I not read this? Did I read this accurately in one of the biographical articles?
No, I don't think so. I mean, my parents are divorced.
Mm-hmm. But he didn't vanish
in
the way that the lost father did.
No.
Because there was so much detail, very interesting detail, about how to find someone.
Yeah.
As though you actually did engage a detective and look for someone, you know, tracking down social security numbers and birth records and all of that sort of thing.
I wanted the character to be on essentially a spiritual quest which took a material form, you know, which took place in all the matter-of-fact ways it could. When I was little, actually, when I was a child, there was sort of an apocryphal story in my family, which I didn't know firsthand because I was very, very young. But my grandmother had a brother who'd actually vanished. And I think at one point he'd joined the Merchant Marines. Other points he'd had some other sort of jobs on ships. But anyway, when his father died, my grandmother engaged a private investigator and found her brother so that he could come back to the funeral. And he was found and did come back, did go to the funeral and stayed at home in that sort of small Midwestern city for a while, but didn't like it and missed his wilder, more adventuresome life, and eventually took off again. And she had to get the investigator, I don't know if it was the same one or another one, again when their mother died, to find him again. And I think that after that she gave up. But so I heard those stories when I was little.
It's kind of hard to just vanish in this country, isn't it?
People do. I actually, you know, you learn a lot, actually, from, you make these things up, and they seem real to you, but then, like, with the first book, with the first scene in the first book, is a mother putting her daughter out by the side of the road when they have a fight and saying, well, you know, get out then. And the daughter gets out, and the mother drives off a while, and then she turns around and picks her back up again. But that had never happened to me, and I don't have any children yet, so I'd never done that to anyone, and it was something I made up. But when I sometimes would go around and give readings, really quite a few people came up to me afterwards and said, you know, I did that. That happened to me. And the same thing has been true with the lost father. I mean, I think none of us sort of make things up in a vacuum. We live in this world. We live in this culture. We probably even, our imaginations are greatly shaped by the culture we live in and the sort of yearnings, the primal yearnings in the air, because an astonishing number of people have told me that they haven't seen their father since they were three, or they don't know where he is, or they saw him until they were five, but since then he's vanished more or less.
I guess that's, in a way, the result of the nuclear family, where families break up and split up and go their separate ways.
There's something that seems very appealing about that life, but it seems mm-hmm. like a life that's so lost to most of us. It seems like another age.
Now back to the lost father. Mayan becomes obsessed with the fact that her father, she has not seen her father since she was about 13, and this obsession apparently dominates her entire life. Tell me a little bit about that and her motivation for this quest.
Well, I was writing about a character who really did feel that the absence of her father and having grown up with the father was, I wanted her to be someone who, for most of her youth, said, it's fine, it's okay, I have no problems with him. I didn't even really know him very well anyway. You know, I've got my mom, I'm doing fine, don't feel sorry for me. And then I wanted there to be, then at a point in her life, in her 20s, I wanted the results of that to catch up with her a little bit, and for some of the sorrow that she'd never really expressed or been aware of to come up, probably also in her relationships with other people, with her boyfriends in her life. I wanted her to begin to think that some of the problems she was having in her life might be connected to that, and to have the hope that by finding him and there might be some solution for her and some sense of resolution to some of her problems.
But she lets this obsession, in effect, disrupt her life, doesn't she?
Mm-hmm. Well, most obsessions or missions of that kind, I think, do. And I wanted it to be a radical mission. I mean, I also wanted to write about what it's like to grow up in an age where we don't have many spiritual or religious guides that are there either, any protectors in that form, any sort of paternal, you know, I think there's, many of us feel we didn't grow up with a solid faith, a solid community, a solid political leadership or a spiritual leadership. So I wanted her to be also searching out that and testing the veracity of her hunch that somewhere this person or this being exists.
Yeah, in a way, Mayan is rather rootless. Mm-hmm. Outside of her, I think her grandmother was the anchor for her life.
I think searching for her father by that time had taken over her, mm-hmm. her life for the moment. And I wanted that to be true. I wanted there to be some real stakes for her. I didn't want it to be a kind of dalliance. I wanted her to feel that to either find him or to find out that she couldn't find him, or to find out, to see if he did or did not exist. I wanted it to be an imperative question, not a sort of whimsical question, but a very visceral, imperative question for her life.
Her research even takes her to Egypt, because her father was born in Egypt. These are, and all of the places that you write about, in the Midwest and in California and in Alexandria and Cairo, they seem so real. Hey, you must have been to all of these places to have that
well,
vivid
actually,
imagery.
The Egypt section I wrote first without having been there or, you know, been anywhere near there. But then I went, actually, to check it, to make sure I didn't do anything too wrong, make any big mistakes. And I hadn't made too many mistakes, actually. But it was a great trip anyway, and I got a few other details. I picked up a few things that I put in.
And did you indeed drive up to Alexandria?
I actually went to Alexandria. I don't believe I drove. I think I took the train.
Mm-hmm.
But I found out how long it would take if I had driven.
And obviously you've scoured the Midwest.
Yes, I've scoured the Midwest many times.
I envy you. I've been so long since...
You don't ever go back? You should.
No.
It's lovely. You should, even just in the summer. You know, take a month.
The fall, maybe. The fall or
the
spring.
The spring is beautiful.
Yeah. Well, it's not giving away too much to say that ultimately Mayan does find her father. In a way, the discovery is not exactly what she expected, is it?
No.
Can you comment a little bit about that?
I think at that point her search had become so insistent and large that her father ended up being just a man who had problems of his own and who was kind in some ways and accepting but disappointing in others. Then she went back to her life then. I think she went back. The last line of the book is, I'm more like everybody else. And I think that's what I wanted her to be by the end of this quest or this mission.
Are we going to see Mayan again?
Maybe sometime. Not in the next book, anyway. Not in the next book.
What are you working on now?
I'm working on a book now set in California about six main characters. The character I'm working with most right now is a young man who's quite bright and active and ambitious, but has lived in a wheelchair all of his life, since he was old enough to have one. He's the artist in the book, and then I have a scientist. And it's about a sort of bunch of young people with very different backgrounds, but different privileges and lacks of different privileges, different obstacles, all at the sort of their middle to late youth when they're beginning to have real decisions and disappointments and successes and failures in their...
Well, this is a general idea about the characters, but
yeah.
Do you, when you start to write, do you have a carefully plotted outline?
No, I've got about 150 pages of it, but I don't really have an outline.
But you have some idea where you're going.
Yeah,
maybe you don't. A lot of people don't.
I sort of know what's going to happen. I know now, but I'm, you know, I've written 150 pages. I didn't know when I started. So I know what's going to happen.
Have you ever found yourself in the position of writing 150 pages or 200 pages and then saying, this doesn't work?
Mm-hmm.
It must be frustrating to have all those pages and all those hours and days of work and then to put it to the side.
I don't know if it's exactly like that. I mean, I always think that... I mean, actually, the book I'm working on now, I started before The Lost Father. I started after Anywhere But Here. And it just wasn't coming together. I had all kinds of pieces, but I just didn't know how they would come together. I'd have a scene here with these three characters and a scene over here with a whole different family who there was no evident reason to me they would know these characters over here. And finally, after about a year of that, it just wasn't coalescing. So, and this book began, and this took over, so I followed this one. But now, in this new book that I'm writing, I've been able to resurrect some of the things from that, you know, and easily. I mean, I think I did learn some things, but it just wasn't the right moment for it. So I don't believe in waste when it comes to art or literature. It's all, you know, some days you have a day when you really feel, I got something down, but other days you don't. But I think really they're all the same. I mean, I think, you know, it's all a matter of learning. It's not just the product.
Well, the way you describe that process, it reminds me of something Joyce Carol Oates was saying. She says when she is creating a work of fiction, it's like a big puzzle of your own making and trying to put all the parts together. I thought that was a wonderful description of writing a novel, you know, creating a puzzle. Perhaps solving a puzzle.
Yeah, I think that's true. And then, too, I know a potter who makes, you know, pots. And she does, I think, sort of Japanese, some Japanese techniques I don't fully understand. But she's very good. And apparently there's a certain kind of pot with a very narrow base that could almost not support the rest of it. That's a very hard design to make. But she did it on the wheel one day. And then after it was done, the dog or the cat, I don't remember what animal she had, knocked it over. But it didn't bother her, really, because that wasn't the point. The point was that she'd done it. And it's a bit like that with fiction, too.